sound of the Mac. Steve Jobs lives. Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're just going to work through our agenda today of some reports and updates and briefings. Somewhat bittersweet today. It's the final Senate Finance and Revenue Committee hearing with Dr. Paul Warner, who's announced his retirement effective December 1st. And so we'll carry on. However, there's some other events. I think he'll be recognized on the Senate floor tomorrow. We still have the economic forecast November 29th here with the joint committees, where there may or may not be a special presentation. And then there will be a party in the rotunda following the forecast. I won't say celebration of life. That sounds a funeral, but it'll be a joyous affair.
Mr. Chair, he's an economist. He's going to be liberated, so he's going to be starting life once he gets out of
prison. Yeah, listen, you'll be out. Your personality can now come out.
Yes. Yes.
That's right. So let's start with you, Dr. Warner, and give us – we have some bills that are going to LC for committee bills for the 2018 session, just general descriptions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know the deadline is next Tuesday at 5 for bill draft requests, and we've been working on three with the chair. And one would be a technical bill related around tax credit, tax expenditure issues. We had one around film and video. And we typically get some more as we work through the process. We work with Department of Revenue. We also are looking at a bill to address some apportionment issues around corporate income tax. And so that's something that we'll request as well. And then the third issue is the reconnect. Well, the chairs have discussed the annual reconnect, and the House is not introducing one, so there'll be one introduced in the Senate. And we'll talk about, Chris will talk some about what we know about the federal tax plan. The reconnect oftentimes, as you know, it's just a technical bill, but given the potential changes in Congress, it may be much more than that. Mm-hmm. And so we'll kind of talk through and try to set a framework for the kind of issues you may have to deal with in February, and this would be one of the vehicles you could use to address those.
Okay. Good. Any questions on the committee bills for 2018? Nia Ray is here. We're going to have a chat with her about the budget and the thing. So if you want to come up, Madam Director. You've got a wingman.
Good morning. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I'm Nia Ray, the Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. And the purpose of today's presentation is to provide a very high-level overview of the department's 17-19 legislatively approved budget. 2 months ago, we provided a similar presentation to the House Revenue Committee. Evidently, it was fairly well received. I've been asked to do a similar presentation for you here today. But the presentation that we will provide to you not only gives some insight into the numbers associated with the budget, the GF, the OF, the FTE, but some insight into the discussions that were had during our budget hearings. Some of you may have heard that there were some very detailed discussions had between the department and the Ways and Means Committee about departmental expectations, the role the department was expected to play, and how we measure our accountability. So this presentation will share some of that with you and where we plan to go forward from those hearings. So, first, we'll recap the budget hearings. We will then provide a budget note summary. The department was assigned 9 budget notes, which I understand is quite a few budget notes, and provide a budget overview, including our POPs, and then share with you the progress we've made on several pieces of legislation that the department is in the process of implementing. So first, the budget hearings. The department again, had some significant and in-depth conversations with the Ways and Means Committee about expectations. And those hearings involved a standard and ordinary 1 week of phase one discussions and then 2 weeks of phase two hearings. And those phase two hearings involved overturning many stones that had not been overturned for quite a while in the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue has had the luxury of implementing gin tax for quite a few years, and that has been a focus of the department. However, we are moving away from implementation of gin tax and moving back into other areas of the department that may not have received the same level of attention because of the level of effort required in making that project a success. So there were several categories that the concerns fell into. The first was gin tax. Gin tax, first of all, an update, the final phase of the project was initiated and implemented this weekend, and we are still in the process of implementing that final phase and completing the implementation of that final phase. But at this point, no news is good news. It appears to be successful. That said, after the final implementation, we are moving into a phase of utility and stabilization. And what we found during those budget hearings was that we may not have, as a department, managed expectations of both our taxpayers and our legislative, the legislative body with respect to what our role and what this will look like after we implement. And implementation will have its challenges. We have a staff that has been largely accustomed to a legacy system for the past 25 years. We're moving into a new system. There's change management that has to occur. In that respect, our taxpayers will also incur a different level of accessibility to the department and perhaps more communication from the department. And so understanding those workload shifts, understanding what those expectations should be is important to ensuring that the perception of the Gen Tax project remains positive and successful. So we will, as a department, do a better job of communicating with this and other legislative committees to ensure that you clearly understand what to expect from Gen Tax. You understand when your constituents may receive a higher level of communication, when those workload shifts occurs, when we're able to communicate with taxpayers more efficiently, you get more calls because we are better able to identify and communicate with those taxpayers that we perceive to have a liability. So we really need to manage that process. That said, Gen Tax, by and large, is still perhaps the poster child with respect to implementation. We were able to implement the entire project on schedule and under budget, which is a feat from what I understand, given some of the success rates of other projects of this magnitude throughout the state. The second category of concern was our staffing. At the time of the hearings, the department had roughly 170 vacancies. It's a lot of vacancies. And the vacancy level was born from a fairly well thought out plan and concern to avoid layoffs. The department understood that we would be in the midst of financial constraints during the remainder of the year, anticipated some layoffs and cuts potentially. And so to avoid laying off ultimately and to accumulate some budget savings, there was a hiring freeze, an internal hiring freeze placed on our staffing. That said, it went too far. And so by the time we were before the Ways and Means Committee, we had 171 vacancies that we had to account for. The budget rectified some of that. They swept 80 of those 171 positions and restored roughly 75, I think, of those positions. And so the math is a little skewed, but 75 positions were restored. Since July 1st, we have hired 52 of those 75 positions and plan to hire the remainder of those positions by the end of the year. It was a very it was a significant undertaking by the department to do that level of hiring in such a short period of time, but it needed to be done. The legislative expectation was that we would get that done. And quite frankly, our staff needed for that to happen. With that level of vacancies, there were workload burdens placed on our staff that we needed to address. So we're very pleased to have made that effort. The third area of concern was one of our KPMs. Our customer service KPM was at a 13% overall satisfaction rate, and that is objectively low. So there was some explanation of, number one, how we got to 13%, what that really meant, and how we plan to address that 13% and pull that up closer to the 98% or 96% that's actually the goal. Fairly high goal. However, 13%, we could certainly do better than 13%. So what we explained during that hearing was that as a department, we did some soul searching, did an assessment of how we got to 13% and realized we needed external help. So we contracted with OSU and a private vendor, Propeller, a customer service vendor, to help us understand what we needed to do differently to, number one, change the satisfaction rate, and number two, ensure that we had the right tools in place to collect the level of data that we needed. So we are still working with Propeller to address some of those concerns, but we're moving in the right direction. We've gone from 13% in 2016 to 65% in 2017. So we're clearly doing something right. There's some room to grow, but we as a department believe that we are working toward meeting the legislative expectations with respect to meeting taxpayer standards of customer service. The final area was just general accountability, how we measure what we do. How do we know we're successful as an agency? What tools do we use? And we weren't able to answer those questions in a manner that was comprehensive, I think, enough for the legislative body. So several of these concerns have resulted in the 9 budget notes that we will go over with you today. The first is a collections division feasibility study. That feasibility study was initially scheduled for report in November. Deanna Mack has graciously accepted a temporary position as our collections division administrator. Of course, she was a legislative liaison for personal income tax prior to. She will remain in that role, we believe, until February. But the purpose of that study was to determine whether our collections structure, whether the way we operate as an agency with respect to collections is the most efficient. Right now, our collections efforts are disparate. We have a collections unit in each program. So the question is, should we remain organized in that fashion? Is that the most efficient way, or should we consolidate? Should we remain in separate programs with an individual that serves as a manager for each of those to consolidate the accountability measures of each of those units? Those are the questions we're asking as we research on our collections division and the feasibility of either of those options. The second is a comprehensive external audit. We have experienced some personnel and some administrative issues within our finance section. And those issues have been noted through Secretary of State audit. There have been some concerns expressed in other areas of finance management throughout the state. And so the legislature, through budget note, has require the department to engage with a private sector vendor to conduct a finance audit, a finance management audit of our finance section. And that audit is scheduled for a report in September now because of the procurement requirements. So it was pushed out. The audit was initially scheduled for February. It will now be reported in September. The third is related to two. It's a state accounting and budget review. As stated, we've been encountering some issues in our finance department. So the Department of Administrative Services will be working with the Department of Revenue, has established a peer group to perform an independent audit of our finance unit. That review is due in February. The legislature, the LFO, and the legislature are very comfortable with there being two separate audits of the same structure. And we will reconcile the results of both once those results are issued. The fourth is an outcome-based management assessment. And as I stated, the legislature had some significant concerns just about our accountability, how we measure what we do. We have many, we have data that feeds into what would be an outcome-based management assessment, but at the top, there's no performance management system. So we are required to create, with external help, through a procurement process, a performance management system to govern the department's outcomes. And that management system will be reported in December of 2019. The 171 vacancies that I reported, though we are moving in the right direction and are hiring to fill those positions, we will provide a review of our personnel practices and legislatively authorized positions in conjunction with DAS's HR department to determine how we manage our workload, our use of work out of classes, double fills, temporary positions, all of the various designations within our workforce, how we are using those, and whether they align with statewide policy. That presentation will be given, that report will be given in February. We are moving forward with upgrading our and modernizing our processing center. We attempted that several years ago in 2016, I guess maybe 2 years ago in 2015, 2016, we were not successful. So we are taking another bite of that apple with legislative support, but we will be presenting on the progress of that project in February. The KPM resulted in improving delivery of taxpayer assistance report, which will be presented in February. And the purpose of that report is to further identify and to hear from the department ways to improve the delivery of taxpayer assistance, what we do right now, and what our relationships with OSU and Propeller and those external resources that we've tapped into, how they've benefited our delivery of taxpayer assistance. Yesterday, I completed Budget Note 8, which was a report on the 2018 tax processing season. And the committee was interested in how we prepare for tax season, how we define tax season, and all the resources involved in ensuring that we are ready for any given tax season. We actually presented twice. The first time we presented on personal income tax season. The committee suggested that we come back in November after the presentation in September and provide a more comprehensive approach to our tax season readiness across all programs. So we presented that yesterday. And from the reaction of the body at that time, I think we hit the mark that time. Finally, we will provide a core system replacement project update, Gentax update, and at that point we will have implemented all four phases. We will report on, we hope, the successful implementation of all four of those phases, but that report will be provided also in conjunction with DAS. And so what you see throughout these budget notes is, number one, there's been, there is an influence of external private sector vendors and ensuring that the assessments are indeed objective. And there's also sponsorship by DAS to ensure that there's a statewide component to any assessment or any results that we lend and share with the committee. So those are our 9 budget notes. We're clearly very busy with budget notes. 4 or 5 of those reports will be given in February. So we will be a very busy department between now and February. With respect to the actual numbers associated with our budget and the funding, I share with you that we lost 80 positions, but we still have 933 FTE and 1,007 positions. Our general and other fund, there was a variance of, I believe, 4%. But there was a variance between our funding this year and the funding from 2015 and 2017. So we are in the process of reconciling our budget and ensuring that we are able to provide the same level of service required. Moving on. There were several POPs approved in this budget cycle. Post-CSR implementation, the department requested a fairly high level of post-implementation maintenance. And the legislature agreed that that level of maintenance was required to ensure the level of investment was protected. So $4.5 million of GF and $869,000 of other funds were provided to provide that level of maintenance. POP 104 is the final phase of Gentax and completion of that actual of the project. So those are the remaining funds to complete the project. As stated, the project appears to be completed as we implement the final phase 4. If you have not had the opportunity to do so, the department has built very successfully a payment center to handle all of our in-person payments, both cash and otherwise. There were several payment options due to the programs that we had, and it created not only security risks, but administrative burden as well. And so we have created a payment center, built a payment center, very secure operation that is simply remarkable. It's very impressive. If you have not had the opportunity to visit, please do. POP 111, we do have security within the building, so we increased the OF limitation to cover costs associated with the physical security services provided by OSP. As mentioned, we are re-engaging our processing center modernization, so we were appropriated funds to that end. Legislature, in an attempt to ensure that our finance section continues to work toward meeting certain objectives, they authorized 2 positions for a full-time accounting manager and a fiscal analyst, too. Both of those positions have been filled. And finally, POP 806, our customer service resources. We have a full-time public service representative for that was authorized during the budget, and there were 2 pieces of legislation that were passed to enhance our customer service efforts. They involve 2 phone lines that are specifically designated for various industries. First is for business representatives, a line dedicated to businesses to call and receive the level of taxpayer assistance customer service required. The second is for the CPA community. And so we were designated a public service representative for to assist with both of those phone lines. Those phone lines will be implemented on January 1st. We are asking for patience from both those communities and the legislature as we implement those phone lines. We did not receive staffing associated with with those packages, with, the legislation. So we are doing the best we can with what we have. And after perhaps a year of functioning, we will petition the legislature with more information on what's needed. We will be engaging with both of those industries to determine how the level of satisfaction and what they need from these phone lines to ensure we meet the mark. So before we move to questions, there are there were several pieces of legislation, far-reaching legislation, that the department is in the process of implementing. The first is the transportation package, the vehicle, bicycle, and statewide transit tax. The department is in the process of implementing those various taxes. We're in frequent communication with the Department of Transportation to make sure that we're in sync with respect to their expectations. At this point, we are from September to November, we anticipate the department being in the implementation phases, ensuring that our systems are configured, ensuring that our communication strategy is clearly executed, ensuring that all of the systems involved in making this a success are up to date. And so we believe that we are in the green with respect to a January 1st implementation deadline for the vehicle and bicycle. Of course, the statewide transit will not be implemented until July 1st. We will have the opportunity to create a more in-depth and more hopefully far-reaching communication strategy for that program. The second program, the second piece of legislation was our other agency accounts legislation, Senate Bill 1067. And that legislation was designed to enhance our collection efforts. There was, given the financial constraints that the state found itself within, there were collections concerns raised by the legislature and collections efforts made by the governor through executive order to ensure that all state agencies, including the Department of Revenue, were really working together to ensure that we were collecting most effectively. So 1067 was born from that, and it requires, essentially it requires the department to collect all the debt associated with many of our state agencies. So to that end, we are working closely with DAS to ensure that the department, number one, understands what those workload, those new workload requirements will be, understanding the needs of the stakeholders, the sister agencies that will now be transferring their debt to the Department of Revenue. And finally, all of those measures will be reduced to an ask, a legislative ask in February for resources to that end. There were no resources appropriated during the legislative session, so we will be making a February ask for both transportation and for OAA. There will are some additional resources needed to ensure that the statewide transit tax is implemented most effectively. And the final legislative success that we'll mention today was the financial institution data match, another collection effort. We are currently in the process of working through to ensure that we make that legislation and the intent of that legislation of success. There is a procurement element to that, however, so we are working to procure the level of service required to make that a success. And that really concludes my presentation for today. So if there are any questions.
Thank you. I do have one question. Sure. You said you had the 170 vacancies swept. Was that, did they went away? Was that voluntary? Was that because of 1067? Was that just a Ways and Means action?
Sure, yes. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist. We had 171 vacancies at the time of our legislative hearings. And so of those vacancies, we lost 80 of those positions. 80 of the positions were swept. And we retained roughly 75 positions. I know those numbers don't quite add up, but there's a science around that. But we retained roughly 75 of those positions. And those are the positions that we fill. So they did, the legislature did not sweep through the entire 170.
But they swept 80.
They swept 80.
Just, that was just a Ways and Means action, or was that 1067?
No, that was a Ways and Means action.
That's right.
And they, when they swept the 80, they did communicate that they would be willing to engage with us to restore those positions as needed, but they wanted additional explanation from the department to ensure, number one, our management of our positions was sound, and number two, that they understood the direction of the department. So there will probably be subsequent asks as we determine the need for those 80 positions that were swept.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. Follow-up. Madam Director, you said you filled those other 70. Some positions have been filled.
Of the 75 positions, we've filled roughly 50, either 52 or 54 of those positions. We plan to fill the remainder of those positions by the end of the year. Vacancies, of course, aren't static. You know, people retire, people quit. So we have accumulated more vacancies since July 1st when we had the 75 and we began filling those 75 positions. That said, our goal is to move as closely to the finish line as we can and fill as many positions as we can between now and the end of the year.
Thank you, Madam.
Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier on this season, we had a conversation about how people file the different forms and stuff,
sure.
And I've shared my concerns that, you know, a lot of people in the rural communities don't have the internet access and to file by internet. And I just, you know, has the department looked at that any more seriously? I mean, my personal feeling is that any form that needs to be filed by an Oregonian should have an option of paper. And I know that sounds old-fashioned, but given the internet opportunities in some of the rural communities, it is pretty tough. It really is. You know, and I had some of your folks say, well, you can go down to the public library. Well, you know, a lot of our communities don't have public libraries anymore. So, you know, have you taken a look at that? Any closer?
Sure. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, Senator Bartsugar, we certainly took your concerns very seriously. We took your concerns back to the department, had conversations about it, and are working through a few options. I'll share some of those options with you. First of all, we're reviewing the forms that we send to businesses. The goal in promoting electronic filing was cost effectiveness for the department, and there are many businesses that can, and it's in the ordinary course of their business, they already file most of their forms electronically. But we certainly heard your concerns about those in the rural community that simply don't have those resources. So first, we're taking a look at our forms to ensure that the wording is reflective of perhaps a softening of some of those requirements so that individuals that can't understand that there may be another option. Also, pursuing our internal rules, our administrative rules, and perhaps creating a hardship exemption for those businesses that simply can't. So we certainly heard you, and we want to ensure that we meet the objectives of the entire state and meet everyone where they are without necessarily creating a sense of, you know, of moving backwards with respect to the progress we've made with respect to efficiencies. So we did hear you, and we are working on it, and we will be in frequent contact with you to ensure that we're on the right page.
I really appreciate that, you know, and I think that we ought to continue to try to, you know, encourage people to file electronically. It's obviously the right way, but, I mean, in my example, we have internet to the barn, but we don't have internet to the house where I live. So go figure.
Yes.
So I know even in high-speed internet is now becoming an issue because some of us, we have internet, but it's not high-speed. So it doesn't work as well as you would like it to work on certain applications. So I appreciate you doing that.
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much for that presentation.
Doctor,
and Connie, for your help.
Mr. Chair, before we go on with Kyle and his report on property tax collections with the assessors, I did want to mention our new economist is with us. And she's sitting next to Kyle there, Jamie McGovern. She started yesterday. So this is her second day, and we're glad she's joined us. She's spent some time with the Public Utility Commission, and most recently with the Citizens Utility Board. She's done some university. She's a professor working in the state university system in New York for a while. And she got her training from Arizona State. So I haven't checked the records, but I think she's our first Sun Devil.
Yeah.
Condolences.
Welcome aboard. Thank you. Some transitions coming up. Of course, I guess I left out the part this morning that in your absence while you're fishing and golfing, Chris Allenack will be the interim legislative revenue officer. So we're lucky to have him agree to that. And we'll move on to Kyle and the assessors.
Do you have a presentation, or is it all? Is it all?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes. So, tomorrow is actually the first deadline for, or the first installment of property tax payments. So, we thought it'd be a good time to do what's quickly becoming an annual tradition, I think, for this committee, but that's to give the committee an update on property taxes, the overall impose, kind of what's going on, and then we also invite a panel of three assessors to come and share more detailed information of what's going on in their counties, the trends in values, impose, and then also some of the more specific things that maybe that's going on in their county or in their region. So before we'll invite the three assessors up, I do have a document in OLIS, it's in the meeting materials titled LRO Initial Property Tax Trends. And it goes over at a very high level, a very the statewide imposed figures, and I also have some county figures as well. And just as a reminder, these numbers are preliminary. They do come in from the assessors. They go into Department of Revenue. Department of Revenue does quite a bit of work to get it into a functioning database that they can then publish kind of what's been going on the last year, and then we use that again for our own reporting and modeling purposes. So these are preliminary, but at this high level, the statewide figures, we wouldn't expect anything to change as updates are coming in from the counties. But referencing that document, let me get it pulled up here. Okay, so the overall trend, you can see year-over-year growth from 15-16, from fiscal year 16-17 to 17-18, we've seen growth of about 6.8%, from $6.4 billion to $6.8 billion. And again, this is statewide total property taxes imposed. This would include permanent rates, your local option levies, bonds, and also any of the special assessments as well. So this is the largest sum figure you'll generally see for the property taxes. And I do have...
Kyle, could you give us a quick refresher course on if there's the 3% Measure 50 rate, why these are twice that?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair. So that's a very good point. So again, you can think of property taxes almost in really three primary streams. You have those that are coming from the taxing districts on the permanent rates. So those are the rates that are fixed for each taxing district, has a fixed maximum permanent rate. They can always impose less than that. But in many cases, they're imposing the rate that is their maximum rate. And so you take that rate and you multiply that by the maximum assessed value of a property, and you get the imposed property taxes on the permanent rate side. And that's where that 3% growth limit in maximum assessed value for each property comes into play. So you see that 3% limit that's in the Constitution generally will limit that permanent rate growth to 3% for each property, and then you pick up more than 3% just by new properties coming on the roll. So you get 3% year over year for properties that are the same property as there in the prior year, and then you get new property as well, new homes being built, new commercial property, industrial property, and the like. So we tend to see that in 3.5%, 3.4%, 4% sometimes, year over year. The other two streams are you have local option taxes. Those are voted on by the voters within the taxing district, and those are traditionally five-year levies. They can be less than that, and those, are again, are voter-approved local option levies. So they're temporary levies. They are subject to the Measure 5 constitutional limits, but they are additional taxes that can come and go. So when you see big upticks in certain counties, a lot of times that's going to be either a local option levy or that third stream, which is bond levies. So again, those are district bond levies. They're voted on by the voters in the within the act, the specific district. So whether it's a school district, county district, or a city district, and those can definitely run longer than the 5 years. That's the payoff the levy that's being voted on. But so your two big contributors to your growth, other than maybe that initial 3%, 3.5% for the permanent rates, is going to be driven largely by a local option or a large bond. And when you see those year over year, that might be a new bond coming on the scene that was voted by the voters in the previous election. And that's one, just to go down a little bit, you can see Multnomah County is shown here, has about 11% year over year growth. And again, it was last year that Multnomah County had the low-income housing package that was supported by the voters. So that's quite a bit of the growth there. And certainly you can see another one, Josephine County. If
law enforcement levy.
Scroll down. Yes, there was a jail levy that passed as well. So you can see that's part of the reason you see that large 18%. And then many of the other counties, you see growth rates closer to that 3%, in some cases less than that. Again, that could be a bond levy expiring or a local option levy expiring.
I'm moving to Morrill County.
And one of the things is, at the risk of giving this information at the detailed level of the counties, is it's still a little bit of time before we'll be able to unpack the data that will come through from the assessors and say, well, how much of that was local option, how much of that was a bond. Right now, these are just the highest level figures. But the general takeaway is, if you're seeing growth much above 4 or 5%, there's probably a new levy that was voted on in the previous November that's being picked up this first year. But just going through the top two charts there, you can definitely see that while property taxes have stayed positive year over year for the past 10 years. You can see the pickup following the housing bust, if you will. We had some years where the growth was below 2%, and now we're closer to the 5 or 6%, which matches more closely to those 10-year trends and the trends since 97-98. Last 10-year trend, about 4.3% is our average year-over-year growth, compared to 5.2% since Measure 50 was fully implemented. And then the last chart I would just draw your attention to on the second page here is, this is the compression reduction. So this is the reduction in property taxes imposed due to the Measure 5 property tax limits. And you can see year over year, we're down a bit. And this follows the general trend that you see as we ran into the housing bubble burst, real market values came down, and that puts pressure on the Measure 5 limits. So we saw compression pick up. So that's a reduction in taxes that's actually being imposed by the districts that's not actually being collected, or would otherwise be imposed without the Measure 5 limits, I should say. So you see that compression reduction peaked in about 13-14, and we've been decreasing steadily since. And that follows the run-up following kind of the housing bubble bursting there. So it's proceeding as we pretty much expect, as values are growing again. And then the last chart and graph I have there is the urban renewal imposed. That picked up about 11% year over year in urban renewal. And again, this could be fluctuations that are going on locally. Some of that is the value growth. Also, it could be new urban renewal plan areas coming on the scene. But those are the overall statewide figures. Again, it'll be late winter, early spring before we actually have the finalized data ready to report at the granular level. But this gives you a good sense of what's going on in the overall trends. And again, we do have three assessors here that can tell you a little bit more detail about what's going on in their county.
Questions with Kyle? Okay, Mr. Assessors.
I just want to point out, Mr. Chair, for once I'm happy with my assessor, because we only got 3%, so yeah. I'm happy for him.
Highest in the state.
And you down there, yeah, right. So mine's doing a good job, because we're right at 3% where we should be, and not exceeding anything. So
that's important to him. No, it's just a good job.
Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Scott Langton, Deschutes County Assessor, and I'll start this off with Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'll let my peers recognize themselves as they go through this. So, when you look at Oregon property tax system, our one-size-fits-all model for the state, has very differing impacts depending on which counties and which regions you might be in. As Kyle mentioned, you know, the assessed value growth at being, you know, 3.5-4%, when you look at Deschutes County, it was 6%. But we happen to be one of the fastest growing metropolitan service areas in the nation right now again. So it does have very differing impacts, which we'll see. With that, though, you'll see most of our numbers are up. Assess values, taxes, compression is down. And one thing I'll show on that last graph there, this represents those properties that their market value is lower than that Measure 50 maximum assessed. And as we can see, as values increase, we have fewer and fewer accounts there. And how that impacts individual accounts, you can see the one line representing manufactured structures, that we had a tremendous amount of those in the last 2 years, that now they're, because their market value is increasing, they're coming back down. And with that, those are the type of properties that see huge increases in taxes also, because the market value is a driving factor for the assessed value. So we did get quite a few comments at the counter as far as that. And typically those type of properties, they're becoming affordable housing compared to what other houses are going for. So they're actually appreciating in value in many places. And with that, I go out and do a lot of town halls, talk to different groups. I've talked to some of my peers around the state, and kind of wanted to share with you some of the what we're hearing out on the streets. Now, I guess we'll start it with, what's a positive of our property tax system? And about the positive that we hear is people seem to like the limitation on assessed value growth, so it gives them that stability and predictability. Of course, those are the properties that are on the Measure 50 value and not on their market value, and there is an unpredictability there. The biggest concerns we're happening to see, and this was very true in Deschutes County this year, and when I've talked to Multnomah, Clackamas, other counties around the state, seniors that are on fixed incomes. They have a lot of concern about their ability to continue to pay the increase in taxes. And if you look, most places, their assessed value went up 3% annually for like the last 20 years of Measure 50, if they hadn't had any changes to the property. But their taxes typically went up much greater than that. And that's not good or bad, it's just an outcome of what the wishes of the voters are. And with that, well, like in Bend, because we passed a new school bond, a big chunk of the county went up 5%, even if their assessed value went up 3%, their taxes went up 5%. You look at Multnomah County, it was closer to 11% increase in tax. Clackamas County had areas that were 18%. So those are pretty big jumps in taxes year to year. And with the seniors, with Social Security not even increasing at 3%, those type of impacts are hitting them fairly hard. And I've been hearing kind of an outcry amongst at least certain segments of the senior population asking for some sort of relief. The other one we hear is the inequities between properties, where similar properties can pay very different taxes. Of course, the perceived losers of that are not happy at all. The perceived winners, they don't think it's necessarily fair, but they don't want their taxes to go up. Big surprise. So there's a dilemma to be looking at, and I know this committee has looked in the past at property tax reform, and we appreciate that, but just one of those hurdles to get over. And then just one thing I'll leave you with, too, as we're thinking about, if we are thinking about property tax change, I was recently at an international assessors conference and heard this said, that overall, and this is nationwide international, assessor said, we don't have a property tax problem. We have a property tax collection problem. And what he meant by that was that no other taxes are at point of sale, such as gas, utility, sales tax. Income tax is typically, you know, it's withdrawn out of your paycheck monthly. Property taxes, you get the bill all at once. And so can you imagine that if you didn't have any income tax withheld for the IRS or the Department of Revenue, and at the end of the year you got the bill for it? And I don't know what the answer would be on how you would look at a collection issue differently if we were to change the system, but just something to think about. With that, I'll turn it over.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'm going to give maybe a little more technical, some things that are going on in Polk County and a few other things. I do have a couple of graphs to show some things, but overall, I think the first graph that will come up is the overall real market value. The overall real market value in Polk County increased by about 13%, and about 2% of that was due to new construction. The total assessed value for all property types increased by 5%, with about 2.3% of that increase due to new property. The residential property, which would be the next graph, saw a over 15% increase with residential new construction. So without residential new construction, the increase would have been about 12%. So basically existing homes, we increased the value on those by about 12% this year countywide. The highest area we increased was about 17% in real market value. The total assessed value increased by 6%. And that goes back to some of the discussion I think that Kyle had, that there's the 3% increase. You were talking more about taxes, but there's the 3% increase that's mandated by law. And the rest of the increase is typically due to new construction, remodeling, additions above and beyond that 3% mandatory. The median value of a single-family home in Polk County increased by 23% last year to $233,000. The median is strictly a midpoint. It can be skewed if there are more upper-end, more valuable homes built. It's not necessarily a true indicator of what an affordable home is. It is a number that can be skewed based on higher-end homes, bringing that median, that midpoint up. But it was a significant increase. Our compression loss this year is down to $285,000, $286,000, down from a high in 2013 of $972,000. And in Polk County, it's almost all in education. There's very little government compression that is lost. There's a couple of things. I did want to bring up the tax collection side. The tax collections have held pretty steady in Polk County, even through the recession. In the recession, we were doing about 95% collection, and that included any prepayment discounts. In 16, it was a little over 97% of the funds were collected in the first year. The funds will eventually be collected as properties sell and the taxes have to be paid or they're foreclosed by a lender. But the 95 to 97% has been fairly stable over the last 10, 12 years. Kyle was also talking about the three pots of revenue, and I don't have any tax collection or tax imposed graphs because it can fluctuate so much. As an example, I think it showed Polk County was a 3% increase, but a lot of the taxpayers in Polk County actually saw a decrease in their taxes, unless you lived in West Salem or in one of the fire districts, because Polk County paid off a road bond that they had at 50 cents per thousand. So the tax that's generated fluctuates on issues that aren't related necessarily to value increase or decrease. There was an article in USA Today insert in the Statesman a couple days ago. It talked about why it's difficult to find a home to buy, and it's the lack of experienced construction workers and lack of space for new lots. We've seen that in Polk County. Most of the subdivisions going in are smaller, 30 lots at a time. The developer may hold 100 acres, but they're only putting in small segments of a subdivision at a time. They don't want to be sitting there holding lots and houses like they were in the recession. Investors are renting their properties instead of selling. There's a fear of capital gains taxes on upper-end homes, and again, this is from USA Today. There's rising borrowing costs, maybe a fear that the Fed's going to raise the interest rate, and a low inventory of homes. They said that nationwide it's 4.2% month's supply. So if no new homes were built, all the homes would be gone within 4.2 months. They believe that a six-month holding period is more of a typical. We've also seen in Polk County the rental market is still very tight. It's there's several reasons for that. Realtors have told me that the homes sell so fast that the sellers don't have a chance to find another home, so they have to go rent. And this was one was really interesting that a realtor told me is that millennials are not necessarily as interested in buying a home as they are in renting because they want to be free to move about for job changes or just they want to experience different things. I'm just checking a couple notes here. At this point, I believe that's all I have as far as a general. I'll wait if there's any questions until we're done, and I'll pass it off to Jim.
Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist. My name is Jim Colon. I'm the Curry County Assessor. Curry County is the county in the extreme southwestern corner of Oregon.
We actually know where you're at.
Okay.
You got on the map this summer.
Well, thank you. Thank you, yes.
Bad news, yeah. But you're on the map.
When we lost about a third of the county, yes.
They didn't pay taxes, though, most of them. So,
I really don't have much different for you in the way of trends than my fellow assessors here. My first graph shows you that what's been happening with real market values and assessed values in Curry County. Since the start of the recession, obviously values went down dramatically in Curry County. But you do see that there's a fairly straight line appreciation in assessed values during that time. And then my next graph just really shows you what was happening during that same time period as far as tax collections. There were a couple of new local option levies that were passed during that time period, a couple of new bond measures. And so in a 10-year period, our property tax collections in Curry County, it's a small county, have risen from about $20 million for the 42 or so districts up to about $27 million. So as far as the properties that are on the tax roll, we've been really successful in collecting the property taxes on those. Curry County is probably at about a 95% collection rate in the first year the taxes are levied. Curry County is not a county that suffers from compression to a great deal. Probably less than $10,000 lost to compression down there because our tax rates for other governments are so low. One of the trends that we have noticed in Curry County is that we're leaving money on the table just due to undiscovered properties. And it's a fairly significant number, and I'd be prepared today to discuss that with you, or I'd be happy to come back at another time. There's a few more slides in my presentation. I don't know how much time you have for that.
You're okay.
Okay. Curry County is an ONC county, and so you know what's going on with the ONC counties. Down in Curry County, the assessment taxation budget has been cut back continuously over the years since 2006. In 2006, we had about 13.4 FTEs in assessment and taxation. Today, we're down to about 7.5. And where this assessors really have two ways of discovering properties. The first way is when people take out building permits or other permits with regards to their property. That's how we discover what is new that's taking place out there. And I think all assessors around the state are pretty successful in capturing the value from new construction or exception values within the property tax system. The other method is physical reappraisal. And prior to Measure 5 and Measure 50, the requirement around the state was a six-year reappraisal cycle. That's, we had to get around and reappraise every property at least once every 6 years. Curry County, like many other counties in Oregon, is getting closer to about a 20-year reappraisal cycle. And what we found over the last 5 years or so, if we can go to the next next slide, is we're finding properties like this one where the property was permitted for a garage-like structure there on the left, and what was and we went out and actually picked up that garage structure, and then we finally got around to reappraising this property, and we came back, and this is what we found. We found a much different property than what was permitted, and we estimated that the additional structures were built in 2000. And so we were able to go back 5 years and capture the taxes that weren't collected for 5 years, and that amounted to a total of about $7,000. But we can't go past that 5 years. And so really the districts on this structure lost about $14,000. And if we can move on to the next. This is another example where a structure was built without any permits whatsoever. Once we finally got around to it, again, we estimated it was built about 2000. The omitted property tax liability was around $4,300, but the foregone taxes on this property was about $8,600, taxes that the districts will never collect.
Excuse me, how do you build without a building permit without the, what, I mean?
With a hammer and nails.
Yeah, what isn't there some recourse down the road when that's discovered?
There is. I'm not exactly sure what that recourse is under Oregon's law. I know that our building and planning departments are similarly challenged, and while they're aware of these structures, they haven't been able to go out and do anything with them for whatever reason. This is an example of an ag type building. People can take out a permit for an ag building. You don't even have to pay for the permit. And what we're finding is people are taking out these ag buildings for a building, you know, to store hay in or equipment in. This was an ag building permit, and they built something significantly different. That's an oceanfront, nice oceanfront home.
Barn from the back.
Yeah. Well, I guess the barn is those doors right there up front.
And her bubbles.
Sure. Got to help me out here because, you know, Doug's squirming in his seat next to you. I just want you to know this because help me understand. I mean, Polk County, if you get an ag permit, right, you still pay a fee for an ag, and the inspector still comes out when you're done and inspects the thing. So is that not happening in Curry County?
Can I just want to...
Please do.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist.
In Polk County, from what I understand, you have to get what's called an agricultural permit. It's $25. The planning department reviews the site plan to make sure you're building it on your own property, but that, or you're not building it over your septic tank. Other than that, if there's no wiring involved, no electrical, no plumbing, the building department may not even go out and look at it.
Well, because, I can assure you, as a senator, they come out and look at mine because I get. Well, I just want you to.
Well, you build very nice property. So.
No, I don't. I'm a farmer.
But we try again. If there is an ag permit, we try and go out and look at it. But I think Jim is saying that even if they go out and look at it as an ag permit, and they don't get back and do a cycle appraisal, they could change that. So.
Do we have this problem in Polk County?
I believe we're on probably a 7 to 8 year cycle. So there may be a few properties we might find that we wouldn't be able to collect all the emitted property on. But it is not as severe as what is in some of the southern Oregon counties that were really hit hard by the ONC.
Yeah, Doug, I got that. I mean, okay. What you mean, but you in Deschutes County, I mean, is there a greater problem in the Willamette Valley or over on the eastern side of you just magically, forget the permit, did you just magically find out that at 129, you know, Van Buren Road, there's now a house there magically? Is this a large problem in the Willamette Valley, and is it a larger problem in eastern Oregon, or is it related to the cash businesses in southwestern Oregon?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, I can only speak for Polk County. We haven't found an unpermitted house in probably 20 years, but we did find one. More of what we see are farm buildings, where the farmers, they just build it because they can. So we do find some significant farm buildings. My appraisers are able, because of the shape of the county, the size, we're able to, when they're driving around, they're assigned specific areas, and they know if something looks different, and they'll come back and check. But then we have what I think is barely adequate appraisal staffing to handle that. So we do get out and around the county a little more than maybe some of the rural, truly rural counties may. And Scott may have something for Deschutes.
Yeah, Chair, Vice Chair. I think, you know, when I started this, I said our one-size-fits-all statewide property tax system and how it looks differently. I know in Deschutes County we have a very active code enforcement. So we've done these studies, and we're not on near the cycle of reappraisal that Polk County is. And we're not quite as far out as Curry, but closer to Curry. But with that active code enforcement, we're aware of these, and we've done studies to see, make sure, and taken different areas. And we're just not finding that omitted property. But then as we sit here talking about the statewide system, as assessors, we want to be uniform across the board. And of course, roughly half, 40%, half your property taxes go to K-12, and how that fits in at the whole statewide issue. So then when we do see these inconsistencies, it gives us quite a bit of heartburn, because we want to be fair and equitable across the board given the framework of how our system works.
I know in Washington County that sometimes this happens, not for the reason up there, but because somebody built a guest house on their lot without a permit. And when they're caught, it's rare, but the county has told them to take it down. I mean, large structures dismantled. They're pretty serious about it. So, Senator Bertschinger, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to weigh in a little bit. I know, again, I think this is that urban-rural divide that we see constantly. Doug, you're spot on the ag buildings. You're absolutely right. It's a very mild permit, and they make sure the setbacks and other than that, but there's no inspections at all unless there's a new electrical service. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to get that red tag, you have to have. But if it's a electrical service running from one that's already there, it's not going to be. But, you know, that's not abnormal in rural America. Mm-hmm. You go to Wyoming, or Idaho or some of these other states, there's no permit system. You know, you go to Wyoming and buy a piece of property, there's no zoning, there's no permits, there's nothing. You want to build a house? Build a house. Some of my colleagues in urban areas, you know, they're kind of shocked, but that's not abnormal in rural America. You even go back in some of the rural areas in the Midwest and Eastern United States. It's the same thing. Because we don't have the people. I mean, because of the vastness and the openness and all the miles you have to travel, it's impossible for the assessors to pick everything up all the time. So I'm just pointing that out, that it's not abnormal. This is something that is not abnormal.
Now I understand your hesitancy to introduce this subject.
I told you, Pandora's box.
Yeah. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, I mean, these are a couple of the more glaring examples of what we're finding down in Curry County. There are a lot of undiscovered properties that really don't require a permit. I mean, there's value when people pave the driveway up to their homes and things like that. That can run into a good deal of money. Small sheds, decks, many structures like that don't require building permits, but other non-permitted properties that do require building permits are obviously homes like these, and people oftentimes will remodel their garages as living space for that mother-in-law suite, or a lot of houses were built in the early part of this century with bonus rooms that they left unfinished, and those get finished up later. These are the types of the values that we're finding. We're calling them non-permitted structures just because they didn't take out a building permit to do the improvement. And what we found over the last 5 years is after doing a physical reappraisal on about 17% of the county, we found about $14.5 million in value on non-permitted structures, which amounts to about a 3% assessed value increase for just those accounts that we did. And what that $14.5 million in Curry County raised about $128,000 for the rest of the districts in the county. The schools in Curry County would get the lion's share of that. The other districts are just a little over $46,000. The county's share on that $128,000, since our tax rate is so low down in Curry County, that means about $8,300 to Curry County. However, if we extrapolated that out over the rest of the county, if we were able to get up down to more like a seven-year reappraisal cycle like you have in Polk County, we've estimated that there's probably close to $800,000 in foregone taxes down in Curry County out of a total $27 million in tax collections. That's about 3% of the tax roll that the tax roll is growing by an average of about 3% per year. I mean, if we could see that in 7 years, that would kind of at least double that percentage increase. And of course, once we get the value on the roll, it never goes away and then still continues to increase by 3% per year. So on that foregone tax, most of that goes to the schools, which impacts the state's budget because of the school funding formula you deal with. But hopefully that was understandable. It made sense to me when I was putting it together. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions of the assessors?
It's eye-opening. Thank you. Thank you for presentation. I know tomorrow's the 15th. It's the deadline, so we'll let you guys get back to collecting.
Thank you.
Why don't we take a 5-minute break and come back? I'm going to take a meeting, and we'll talk about the kick.
The committee will come back to order. Mr. Warner, I believe you are up.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. It's that time again for the second consecutive biennium. We have, I did include in your packet the official notification memo from the state economist to LFO and us and to Department of Revenue that certifies the kicker amount. I've written a few of these memos myself back in the 90s. And basically what the state economist has done is taken the calculation amount of revenue above the forecast for the non-corporate. Remember, it's everything non-corporate. So it includes estate taxes, cigarette taxes for the general fund, anything that's in the general fund that's not corporate, and divides it by what his estimate is for personal income tax liability personal tax liability before credits. So, and Chris will walk through some of those mechanics. So that's a change that was made in 07. So you've got a 5.6% calculation, and that's the percentage credit that will go on the tax returns that go out in 18. So we also, the department will come in and talk with you a little bit about some of the administrative issues. Mm-hmm. But if we can look just at a quick history of the kicker, and you can see, remind you about the dates. And one of the things that I think one of the consequences of having a kicker in our system, and I did revenue forecasting for another state, and one of the messages I always got was, well, why don't you, Warner, make sure we don't come in short. So in other words, build a little cushion in there. And because that could be carried forward and used mm-hmm. in the next budget. Well, under the kicker, I think because of the mechanics of the kicker, it has led to a system that is very close to being unbiased. I think your technical forecasters are shooting as best they can for it doesn't mean they're going to be accurate. It just means that they're going to be unbiased over time. And this is what you'd expect over 19 biennia. You'd have it kicker triggered about 10 times, so about half the time. And that's what we're seeing play out in the numbers. This is the second one in a row. The interesting thing about these numbers are that it's 463 million, and that turns out to be just about what the long-term average is. I take all of the kickers, including the ones that were suspended in the 90s, anytime we met the 2% trigger, and so I have a running total, and that's about 3.7 billion on the personal kicker triggered amounts, and then I divide that by total general fund revenue for that period, 79 to 17, and you get 2.3%. And just ironically, it happens to be our current kicker, $463 million, is 2.3% of the 17-19 general fund appropriation. So this gives you an idea of the impact. The revenue impact over time is about, in terms of today's budget, about $463 million. Of course, you may get a 0-1 next biennium and then an 800 the following biennium. But it's the average is about 2.3%. So that gives you a sense of what that long-term revenue impact and keep in mind, the kicker is a revenue limit. That's the role that it plays. So it's a revenue limit. It limits revenue, and that's about the average it limits over time. So I'll turn it over to Chris, who can go through a little bit with the mechanics with you, and then we'll look at the distribution.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Alnack, Legislative Revenue Office. So this is just the actual technical calculation for at the individual level when they determine their kicker amount. So as backdrop, the way the core system works is that we have Oregon taxable income multiplied by the tax rates, the 5, 7, 9, 9.9, and that results in gross tax. When an individual fills out their tax return, those at a conceptual level, that's the arithmetic that occurs. And then the gross tax is reduced by various tax credits. You have child
care. Senator has a question.
Oh, no, sorry. I didn't have
okay.
Sorry.
Go on.
Various credits, earned income credit, child care credits, income taxes paid to other states credits, personal exemption credit, and that results in tax liability. And the tax liability is the core figure that the state economist forecasts for the budget. Now, when it comes time to calculate the kicker, what an individual does is they take their gross tax, they use only one tax credit, and that's the income taxes paid to another state. And that results in what I've labeled here a kicker base. Okay. One of the tricky things in talking about this is that this number right here doesn't have a general definition. If you say gross tax or tax liability, people know what that means. But this number doesn't really have, or this concept doesn't have a name.
Call it kicker base?
That's called the kicker base. And then you take that kicker base, you multiply it by the 5.6%, and then that's the kicker credit. So just on a tax return basis, this is the fundamental math that occurs. So the other slide that I have is the distribution for the kicker. This is still projected. We don't have final 2016 information. This is based on income distributions from 2015. And what we're expecting here in 2016 is just over 2 million tax returns and an average kicker of $229. In that range, I have two different types of distributions here. I have just the straight up AGI. So folks with AGI of less than $10,000 on average will get a kicker of $7. And that number increases to the high income folks with AGI of at least $500,000. And their average kicker will be just under $6,200. And then this other distribution here is a quintile distribution. So we can look at the first 20%. That's about 400,000 filers, and these are folks under about $11,000 of income, and so their average kicker is $8. And that increases, we go up to the top 1%, which are folks over $415,000 of AGI. There are about 20,000 of those folks, and their average kicker will be about $4,600. Excuse me. And again, so that's just a shot at the distributions, two different ways to look at it. And the one number I should have included on here but did not, we got questions on the House side, is the median kicker. And that was about $90. And the median, as you're aware, is the midpoint. So about half the taxpayers will get a kicker credit of less than $90, and then the other half will get a credit of more than $90. And so that's really all I had, just a snapshot of the distribution.
Questions, colleague? If not, I think DOR has some comments, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning. Lois Williams with the Oregon Department of Revenue.
And I'm Ken Ross with the Oregon Department of Revenue.
So just a few administrative items to share with you as we get ready for this upcoming 18 session. Just a reminder that taxpayers will have had to have filed a tax return for 2016 in order to calculate this kicker base. They also would have had to have a kicker base. So if someone doesn't end up with any tax on their tax return, they're not going to get a kicker now. It's not too late to file a 2016 tax return, too. We have people who maybe they thought they would do a refund, so they wait. They have to get that return into us in order to claim the kicker now on their 2017 tax return. They do have to file a 2017 return in order to get this kicker. That's the only way that they're going to get it. Even if they didn't have a requirement to file a return this year, they still have to file it in order to get this kicker. So in most cases, our Gentax processing system can calculate the kicker for people. If they file their return and they, for some reason, leave the kicker surplus credit off, and we recognize that they should have had one, we can adjust their return for that. Or if they claim an incorrect amount, we can also adjust their return for the proper amount. But there are some people that we can't calculate it for. This would be a small group of people who, for example, were married last year, but they are no longer married, so they're filing a different filing status this year. You know, if two single people filed for 2016 and now they've come together and are filing a joint return, we've got their information for both of them separately and we can help combine it. But for those people who were joint and are now filing some other filing status, we just don't have the detail. If all they had was wages, yes, we understand what their income is and we can probably get that data. But when people have income on their return where we don't know, is it one spouse, is it belong to the other, such as rental income or pass-through entity income, it's not always identified whose income it was. Therefore, we can't allocate their kicker appropriately in the following year. So for those people, we provide instructions and we help walk them through how they can calculate that amount. So as indicated earlier with Chris and Dr. Warner, between 1995 and 2001, we used to have checks. But 2 years ago, for the first time, we had the kicker on the return itself as a refund, as a refundable credit. That can be confusing to people. And we did take some calls. We did get some questions about, well, when do I get my check? And we had to explain to them that that's not the vehicle anymore. The process has changed. So that was confusing to people. To help counterbalance that, we did develop quite a comprehensive communication plan last time, 2 years ago. We had news releases. We put information on our website. We put information in the forms and instructions. We work with the practitioner community, and we're going to do all of that again. We've already started. We already have some information out on our website to help people get ready for it. We did also develop an online application called What's My Kicker, where people could put in their information as far as their identifiable information, who they are, and we have enough information behind the scenes to tell them what their kicker amount is so that they can put that on their tax return. The instructions also walk them through. If they want to go back and pull out their 2016 return, we tell them which lines to pick up. But we're trying to make it as easy as possible, so we have this online application. We used it 2 years ago. We are about to bring it up the first part of this year when the filing season opens up. In 2015, we were just transitioning the personal income tax program to our new Gentax filing system. So we had a lot of older data in the prior system, and we have new data going now and new returns going into the new system. It was a little bit of a challenge to combine information from two different systems and give people their information. We did it, but it took a little bit of extra time. We anticipate now that all of the 2016 return data is in the new system, it'll be much more efficient. It's native to the new system. We can do that calculation much simpler and much more efficiently to get that information right back out to people. Also, as part of that transition, we had to redesign the personal income tax forms. We had a space issue, and we took a look at, well, just about everyone is going to claim the kicker, and lots of, you know, thousands and thousands, millions of people are going to claim the kicker. So we need to put that on the main form. In doing so, we took a look at the earned income credit line, and we said, well, a lot of people still need that line too, but we moved it over to the ancillary schedule where people record other additions, other subtractions, and other credits. That caused some confusion for people because they were used to seeing the earned income credit line on the main form. We learned from that, and this year we've brought it back to the main form. So you will see on the Form 40 series a dedicated line for the earned income tax credit and a dedicated line for the kicker right there. So people don't have to have an additional form unless they have those other additions and subtractions and credits. We did take some calls last time because people were confused. As I said, it was the first time for this format for getting the kicker. We took about 1,600 calls directly related to the kicker in our call center, but we anticipate fewer calls this time. For one thing, it was only 2 years ago that people used this same mechanism, so we are hoping that people understand how it works a little bit more. As I just indicated, we've redesigned the forms, and we're going to have that dedicated line for both EITC and kicker on the main form. I indicated also that Gentax now contains that sourced 2016 data, so it'll be easier for us to give them their kicker information. We're going to continue all of the same outreach that we've done before. We've already started our practitioner updates for this fall also, in addition to getting information on our website. So we are well into the throes of it, and we think this will be a smooth kicker year this year. I'm just going to ask Ken if he has anything to offer or add at this point.
I do not.
Okay, but we're happy to answer any questions.
Well, any questions? No, thank you for update. We appreciate your hard work.
Thank you.
I believe Dr. Warner, we're now going to, what are the feds doing, right?
Mr. Vice Chair, yes. We've been trying to decipher what the feds are up to, and a couple things for you. Chris has been working through the 429-page House Ways and Means tax bill. Before he gets to that, I did come across something that's kind of a follow-up. As you recall, in September, we went through the SALT deduction and how that was distributed among some of the states, how it would affect Oregon. And one of the things that we used to get on a regular basis from the federal government was what's something called the balance of payments, between the state and federal budgets. And I always had members that were interested in this, and the feds kind of discontinued this series about a decade ago. And with all the discussion around the SALT deduction, of course, the health care expenditures and links to the federal budget between the federal and state budgets, there's a lot of interest in this. And the state of New York, the Rockefeller Center, went through and did an updated analysis of this balance of payments. So I put that out for you just to kind of give you an update of where that we think we are. And if you look on this, it's in your OLIS on page 3 there. This is their estimates by state, and this is the amount of federal spending per dollar of taxes collected by the federal government by state. And what this is not just transfers to state and local governments. This is all federal spending. So it include defense procurement, Social Security payments to individuals, and so forth. So this is trying to get at this total flow of funds between the state and federal government. And if you look at the numbers there, you can see where Oregon is. And if you look at the latest for their estimates for 2016, Oregon gets about $1.30 in federal spending for every dollar in federal taxes. Now, that's a shift from where we had been historically, at least when the numbers were calculated about 10 years ago. But we are right about in the middle among the states. We're the 26th highest in terms of that terms of trade. And if you go down to the bottom of this chart, you can see what the national average is. It's $1.18. Well, how can the feds give $1.18 for $1 in taxes? Well, that's the beauty of deficit spending. So they're spending 18 cents more, sending 18 cents more back out of the states. So we're right about in the middle. And you know the states that are most concerned about the SALT deduction, for example, and the federal budget, are the states that have some of the terms of trade that aren't positive, like California, for example. You can see they're one of the lower ones, getting back 98 cents per dollar spent. And some of the ones that tend to get the higher amounts tend to be the lower income states. For example, my former employer, the state of Mississippi, is the third highest ratio of $2.31, because their tax base is very low. They actually have defense spending there, and then they have a lot of low-income families that are eligible for certain federal benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's a very disproportionate response to a lot of factors. Now, if you look at the two components, federal taxes paid per capita, you can see on average there on the chart that it's about $9,500 on average, and Oregon is down below that. We're about $8,800 there. And of course, the reason for that is what we talked about in September, is because we are heavier users of the SALT deduction. So, and that has to do with our tax structure, our use of the personal income tax. You can deduct income or sales taxes, but not both. And so that tends to favor those states that have one and not the other, especially the income tax, because it's itemizers that are most likely to be affected. So we pay less than the average in terms of taxes per capita, but we also receive a little bit less in terms of dollars per capita. $11,183 is the average. We're a little bit over $10,000. So, and the net of those two is we have a positive flow. It also, I think it does indicate some of the things you've talked about in terms of the federal budget itself. There's the tax side, and Chris will talk some more about that and kind of what we've learned. But also, of course, there's the budget side and what kind of adjustments the federal government will make in terms of the budget. And again, we're in a position where we would be one of the states that are likely to be affected by both sides of the budget. So just that gives you a sense of kind of what we're looking at in terms of the landscape overall. You can also see on that table, those are the states with a negative balance of payments there. Some of them, like Texas, for example, doesn't have an income tax, so it tends to have a very low SALT payments. States like South Dakota have, North Dakota, Wyoming, they're severance tax states. They tend to have very low state and local taxes that are on individuals, and so very low in terms of SALT deductions. And then there's high-income states like California, New York, that have high tax payments, and they have relatively low in terms of low-income families to receive transfer payments.
Question to the right. So in Oregon, what were we at? $1.28, $1.20
We're at $1.30.
$1.30. Could that also be that we got so many federal lands and so many federal employees that manage those lands? I mean, there's a big chunk of federal employees out there, and they make pretty good wages.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Bettinger, yes, that's definitely part of it. And, you know, we've looked at, we do rank toward the top in terms of transfers among governments as well, because we have the transfers to local governments through because of public lands, but we also have a lot of transfers coming to the state government because of our budget. But the area where we have been right at the bottom, if not on the bottom, is defense procurement. And we don't have, and we don't have large defense contractors, and so that has been an area where we've been lower. We've also traditionally been higher than not a lot of the eastern states, but in the western states in terms of transfers through Social Security, for example, because our demographics are a little bit older population than the West, and now we're still younger than the East, but a little bit older than the rest of the West.
I would just comment that, you know, just for the record, we actually do have a fairly large defense contracting base. We just don't have any prime contractors other than Freightliner and Fleur. There is, I mean, political engineering done by the Department of Defense, and actually in defense spending in Oregon has increased rapidly over the last decade, but it's generally subcontractors to prime mm-hmm. contractors on weapons procurement, everything from Boeing to a handful of other Cascade, some of those other entities. But I would agree with the good Senator Bertschinger that I think, you know, a lot of the federal transfers have to do with federal lands that are owned too. So.
Yeah, rural schools, monies, and all that
kind of stuff. So with that, we'll turn over to Chris to see what we can decipher about what the federal government's up to on tax policy.
So again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So what I have here is just a two-page handout. It's really just to give a flavor or a sense of what we're tracking and what the issues might be as we're trying to figure out what the feds are doing and what each chamber is doing. So things are moving very rapidly, or at least there's a lot of churning at the federal level. So this information is a couple days old at this point. But what I wanted to do was just touch on kind of how our the perspective that we're taking in following this. And the way the federal the bills are crafted is they have four basic policy areas. And the first one are the individuals, and this is where you have tax rates, standard deduction, itemized deduction, those kinds of things. And when we're looking at those provisions there, one of the key things we're looking at is any changes to the tax base. And I'll use the term tax base and taxable income. They're pretty interchangeable, and basically the issue there is any changes in the tax base directly affect Oregon because our tax base is tied to the federal. And then the second category are what they refer to as business reforms. And here we have some of the same issues with respect to tax base, but we also have entity type. And they combine all businesses into one category. And a key thing for us in our revenue stream is separating C corporations from other entity types because they affect our taxes differently. You have the C corporate income tax, and then you have all of the pass-through entities being taxed through the personal income tax, and the potential impact on Oregon is different. So that's one thing we're tracking. The third one is international, and this is where the issue of repatriation comes in, and the big question for us is the corporations that might be affected on the international landscape, to what extent do they have any footprint in Oregon and are paying any Oregon income tax? Because if we could have corporations that are significant in the international scene and are affected by the federal law, but if they don't really have a presence in Oregon, then the impact won't flow through to Oregon. But to the extent that they do have a footprint in Oregon, we could see some impact.
So hypothetically, it's more like Nike or Intel.
Right. Those would be, if they're going to be affected, then we would be affected to some extent. And then the fourth category on, I think this is just on the House bill, they have some exempt organizations, and this is mainly the unrelated business income tax for these entities. I don't think any of this is on the Senate side, and the changes aren't large, but I'm just trying to keep track of all of the different pots that are moving around. So the big, of all the impacts that affect the Oregon revenue stream, we bifurcate those into direct impacts and indirect impacts. And the direct impacts are changes to the tax base. So anything that affects taxable income is going to have a direct impact on Oregon. So if the federal tax base increases, then Oregon's tax base increases, and Oregon taxes will go up. And similarly, if it shrinks, then a reduction in federal taxes will result in a reduction in Oregon taxes. Those are the direct impacts, and those have the larger magnitude. The other category are the indirect impacts, and this is through our federal tax subtraction. On the personal income tax return, taxpayers can subtract or deduct up to about $6,500 of federal taxes paid. So to the extent that federal taxes increase or decrease, that affects the federal tax subtraction. And that is a reverse impact. If federal taxes increase, the federal tax subtraction increases, and then Oregon taxes decrease. So what I have here is just a visual chart for a handful of the direct impact policies and the indirect impact policies. And the key takeaway here is these pluses and minuses, where we have the change at the federal level in federal tax collections and the change in Oregon tax collections. So for the direct impact policies, those that change the tax base, an increase, the signs are the same. An increase or decrease in federal taxes results in an increase or decrease in Oregon taxes. We move in the same direction. For the indirect policies, we move in the opposite direction, and that's because of the federal tax subtraction. And sometimes these can offset. So, for example, at the federal level, they're talking about eliminating the personal exemptions but doubling the standard deduction. And so those will offset. At the federal level, there's a revenue raiser from eliminating the personal exemption, which is a deduction, and a loss in federal taxes due to increasing the standard deduction. So that's another key piece, is how all of these go into the same pot and how they all mix together to get a bottom line impact. And the direct impact policies here, these are some of the larger ones that would affect Oregon. We have the House has a repeal of the medical expense deduction, but the Senate does not. And in the property taxes, this House and Senate are on different pages as to that impact. But these are some of the large policies that we're looking at and could pose questions for you as to a potential response you may want to take to any changes made at the federal level with respect to any of these provisions. And kind of at a bottom line revenue impact concept, I have the chart here where this isn't comprehensive for all provisions in the bills. It's most of the individual impacts, the changes in rates and deductions and so forth. It doesn't include the business provisions, for example. But taking the policy changes and running it through our microsim models, we get over the next 10 years a federal tax cut of about $1.2 billion. That's federal taxes paid by Oregonians. So Oregonians would see collectively a $1.2 billion tax cut and tax reduction of federal taxes. Now that translates into about a $600 million reduction in the federal tax subtraction. And the reason it's not a one-to-one relationship is that the federal tax subtraction is capped at about $6,500. So there's an impact if somebody, for example, is paying $6,000 in federal taxes and they get a cut and now pay $5,000, that would affect Oregon. But if somebody is paying $10,000 in federal taxes and their taxes get reduced to $8,000, then there is no indirect impact, because in either case, they're already subtracting the maximum. So that's why there's not a one-to-one relationship. And then the bottom line for Oregon revenues is, at this point, a very preliminary estimated revenue increase of about $150 million per year. And that's largely driven by the direct impacts of the change in the tax base. The repeal of the medical expenses deduction, for example, is a big piece of that. And this is driven largely by the House policies in the version at the end of the last week. The table I have here highlights some of the differences between the House and the Senate version. And so I have here about a half a dozen provisions where they differ. So I mentioned the medical expense deduction. That's about a $65 million revenue increase for Oregon, just the repeal of that provision by itself. And the Senate doesn't have that provision. So there would be no impact on Oregon because the Senate wouldn't change it. The next two items here are the property tax deduction. On the House side, the property tax deduction would be limited to $10,000. So if somebody is paying $12,000 in property taxes, they would lose $2,000 of that deduction. And that would result in about a $15 or $16 million revenue increase. And again, that's just the indirect or direct impact. On the Senate side, there's a complete repeal of the property tax deduction. So that would be about $250 million per year. So there's a significant difference impact in Oregon between those policies. And the next two here, the educator expense and student loan interest, I've included those. Those are ones that people are familiar with, and those are above-the-line deductions. Everybody gets to claim those. You don't have to itemize. And the item here without numbers is the pass-through rate. I just wanted to mention this because the House and the Senate are going different directions on the pass-through rate. And on the House side, there would be a reduction in the tax rate. This is for pass-through passive income, not active income. They would institute a maximum tax rate of 25%. So on the federal side, that tax rate would be reduced from, say, 39% to 25%. On the Senate side, they are talking about a deduction. So the House version, if it's just a rate reduction, then that likely wouldn't have a direct impact on us, because we have our own rate policy. It doesn't change the base. A deduction, however, changes the amount of that income that would be taxed, and that would likely affect us. And one other note on this piece is, as the committee is well aware, we have our own pass-through tax rate policy. Our preferential rates are for active income. So to the extent that the business owners are involved in the day-to-day of the business, they can get a preferential tax rate. The feds are going in a different direction, and the tax rate reduction here, or the tax preference, is on passive income. So the way they're thinking about that is money invested in these businesses that comes back to the investors who are not involved in the business, it's really more like investment income. So one thing that the feds haven't really touched, at least last time I checked, was capital gains. There's no change to the capital gains rate or the qualified dividends tax rate. This views this passive income from the pass-through entities like investment income, so it brings that rate closer in line to that. So that's one of the policies where there could be a big impact on Oregon or there could be no impact on Oregon. So we're kind of at extremes. And there are a few policies that fall into that category, and which is why it's still all very preliminary and we're tracking it closely. So that was all the information I had on detailed provisions and revenue impacts. The last three categories here, I just wanted to touch on the concepts that we're tracking. And with respect to business tax reform, we're back with we get to revisit our old friends, bonus depreciation and Section 179 expensing. And the bonus depreciation would be extended another 5 years. And we would go, right now it's expected to be phased out, but I believe they'd kick it up to 100% for 5 years. And the Section 179 expensing would also be expanded. The House and the Senate are doing it conceptually the same way, but the amounts that they're including or amounts that they're allowing for this expensing are different amounts. So those will need to be reconciled at some point.
But they'll be permanent. They'll be permanent. 179 will be permanent.
I believe there's been talk of it being permanent, yeah. But the magnitudes are very different in terms of a phase-out threshold being $2 million or $20 million, and the amount of the amount of the investment that can be expensed in a given year is different, and that can have a significant impact. But these are cases where the impacts that the Joint Committee on Taxation provides are just one number, and so a key issue for us is how much of these provisions are C corporations that would affect our C corporation tax revenue versus pass-through entities, which affect our personal income tax. The Section 179 is much more likely to affect the personal income tax side.
And pass-through.
Yeah, and via the pass-throughs, correct. And a third item here, there are a couple of different accounting methods, the accrual method and a cash accounting method. One of the provisions expands the availability of cash accounting, so that would be a revenue hit. Items D and E are actually revenue raisers at the federal level. There's a limitation on interest deductions, and there's some reining in of like-kind exchanges. Those would be revenue raisers that would offset some of the revenue losses of A, B, and C. And so we have the mix of the base, to the extent we're affected, and the type of entity that we need to weed all that out to figure out the impact on Oregon revenues.
Question to the right.
Like-kind exchanges, I mean 1031 exchanges?
Correct.
And we have no idea what they're going to do with those yet?
What I have seen, I don't know what they're going to do, but what I've seen so far is that they're going to eliminate like-kind exchanges except for real property. So, but that this was a couple days ago. I haven't checked it
yet.
Yeah,
I know. So. It's like
Chris, have you seen in either chamber discussions on capital gains tax?
I haven't seen, Mr. Chair, no, I haven't seen any discussion on the change of the rate, which surprises me a little bit. That's usually a discussion in that pops up. So I wouldn't be surprised if it does show up at some point. I'm kind of expecting it to, but I haven't seen it show up yet.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Question.
So since I'm a pretty simple guy, try to, I guess what I'm getting out of this is that if my tax liability decreases on my federal tax return, it will increase on my state tax return.
Potentially. It depends on...
Not the answer I was looking for.
it really does depend on the specifics of your tax return and, okay, why are your federal taxes changing? Because of the mix of policies, for the most part, the bottom line is there are tax cuts in aggregate groups, but there are a number of provisions that are revenue raisers that offset some of the costs. So it depends on the mix for any individual person. So it's exceedingly difficult to say abstractly for a taxpayer, for John or Jane Doe, what their taxes will be. I would have to know the details of their tax return to get some accurate sense. So I'm afraid potentially is really the best I could do at this point. But to follow up on the capital gains, we were talking about this the other day. There is a change for the capital gains on principal residences. Right now, you just have to live in your residence for 2 years, and then there's an exclusion of up to $250,000 for single, $500,000 for joint. The qualifications for that would change to having to live in that home for five of the past 8 years. And so there's a potential capital gain piece there, but it's not the typical capital gains tax rate. So the third item here is international, and I put two things on here. There's a new deduction for foreign source dividends. At this point, I'm not sure exactly if or to what extent that would affect Oregon, so that's kind of on my radar screen to flush that out. And item B is the income repatriation. This happened once before in 2004 or 2005 at the federal level, and this is a big piece where it depends on how the feds implement this policy. This is the policy where worldwide companies have profits that are sitting in other countries. They're profits that they earned outside the U.S., and they're sitting in these foreign countries. Under current law, if they bring that income back to the U.S., if they repatriate it, they have to pay the current tax rates, which could be about 35%. The policy that I've seen so far says that if you bring that back for a certain time period, it will be taxed not at the current rates, but at 5% or 12%. So it depends on the mechanics of how the feds do that. If, for example, if it's brought back and added to the tax form and included in taxable income, then Oregon could see a revenue bump from that. If it's handled completely outside of the traditional 1120 form, then we may see no impact on our revenue stream at all. So it really does depend on the details. As to whether or not it could have an impact. And then there's always the behavioral response, how much of that money would actually be brought back. And then the fourth item, the exempt organizations, there isn't really a lot here. There's some changes to the unrelated business income tax, and this is basically for charities who are tax exempt. If they are running some sort of business on the side and they have some income, that income is subject to the tax if the business is unrelated to their charitable activity. This is really just a footnote, probably more for my use and just keeping track of the things that they're talking about. I'm not really seeing any major changes right here. So the big ones are on the personal side, on the individuals. We have a lot of puts and takes, but right now it's looking about $150 million revenue increase. And on the business side, we're still trying to figure that out.
That's per year?
Per year. Now, that's just for a subset of the provisions, to be clear, and it's the House side. And as an example, reconciling these two, for the provisions I've listed here, the House, a preliminary annual impact for Oregon for the House provisions is $100 million. If the Senate version prevails, that increases by $150 million. So we're still in an area where we can come up with point estimates, but there's a high, significant uncertainty, so a high potential error in those estimates at right now until we get into some sort of conference committee situation at the federal level while they're honing in on the policy. So that's why we're tracking them now.
That's where you come up with the 150, is you're taking a shot in between there somewhere?
Well, the 150 comes from, we have a micro-SIM model. So for just about, for most of the individual provisions, so I can model the change in the federal tax rates, the elimination of the personal exemption, the change in the itemized deductions. So I modeled all that, and that's what this chart represents. And so we start with the change in federal taxes, resulting in a direct impact on Oregon. And the orange line is the change in the federal tax subtraction, so that's the indirect piece. But you throw all those into one pot, so all of the direct and indirect combined are about $150 million. So that does not include, for example, the Senate version for the property tax deduction. That does include the cap of $10,000. So if, they're almost limitless, the number of combinations that they could come out with. But as an attempt to, as an example, if they go with the full repeal of the property tax deduction, then that's going to then that will raise $150 million more. But if instead they go that, or if they get rid of the medical expense, I mean, if they keep the medical expense deduction, then we get less than 150 more than the current estimate. So these are the issues why we want to be on top of. So when they do settle on something, we can come back to you as quickly as possible and say, okay, here's what they did do. We're kind of past talking about what we think they're doing and what they look like they're doing. Come forward and say, here's what they did, and lay out policy options for you to consider for any responses you may or may not want to take in February.
I guess the only thing.
Thank you, sir. Chris, just in reaction time, I mean, many times in the past, the feds have done stuff retroactive. You've looked at this stuff. Is everything proactive? So are we going to have time to react to this, or are some of these things retroactive clauses going back a year in which we're going to be digging quickly?
Most of the provisions start 1/1/18.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
I need to hedge that a little bit because there are 125 provisions.
There's no talk of making them retroactive for 17.
I haven't seen that, but. And the usual ones that come up there are bonus depreciation, Section 179, and those are already, I think, good, if you will, if that's the right term, through 2017. So everything I've seen so far is 1/1/18.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Perfect.
Okay. Chris, I missed that first part. Could you go through it again?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you have a phone call out there so I can gavel us out of here. We can go. Revenue forecast, all right?
Well, thanks for keeping on top of this, and I guess like anything else, we'll stay tuned. Dr. Warner?
Just a reminder, Mr. Chair, we have the revenue forecast on November 29th, which is a Wednesday, and so we'll be meeting in this room with the House Revenue Committee at 8:30.
Okay.
I'll be in Mexico, so.
I'll be in Australia.
You going to miss the big water party?
I'm afraid so.
Afraid so.
29th.
Okay, I'll be here. All right.
Okay. We will adjourn.